All right, folks. Before we get into the episode today, we have an announcement to make. Our producer, Jarek, is leaving us. He is moving on to greener pastures. And we just wanted to say thank you to Jarek for, I mean, almost, is it 4 years, Layton? It's, I mean, it's close to it.
Yeah. Right. Just about.
Yeah. So we just wanted to say thank you to Jarek for being such a big part of this show for almost the entire history of it.
Yeah. Absolutely essential. Show would not be the same without him. Yeah. And not only that, he's just a good dude.
He's a good guy. Like, yep.
A good friend. And we're sad to see him go.
And an amazing kisser.
Also, just like so good at audio editing and has consistently made us sound good and also been a wonderful guest on the show. Many iconic moments with Jarek.
Yes.
So if you enjoy the show, please show some love to Jarek and help us give him a send-off on the lips of an angel.
Yeah. And Jarek, put in that clip of you singing that song right here.
Can you sing a little bit for us?
Yeah. Of course. The hook goes, "It's really good to hear your voice. Say my name, it sounds so sweet. Coming from the lips of an angel. Hearing those words, it makes me weep."
Well, all right,
Jarek, we love you. Yeah. Thank you for everything.
Thanks, Jarek. Bye. Why did I say bye? It was like the end of a show, but I shouldn't have said bye. Keep all this in. Let's keep it. We're keeping it in. Everybody, this is Late Night with Brian Wecht. My name is Brian Wecht. Over here we have Leighton Gray.
Hi, that's me, mystery guest. Would you care to introduce yourself?
Sure, yeah. I'm Pete Etchells. I'm a professor of psychology and science communication at a university in the UK called Bath Spa.
Yeah, and a repeat guest. This is your second time on the show, and we've known each other. It's like we've known each other a while now. I mean, it's probably 6 or 7 years at this point. Maybe
I think
it's got to be more.
I think it was like 2012.
That's right, because I was in the UK. That's right. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oof. Yeah. Yeah. We did Story Collider.
Yes.
And you helped me craft a story that basically got turned into my first book. So.
Yeah.
Everything's your fault, essentially, Brian.
Well, what can I do? I see, you know, incipient talent, and I mold it. That's my whole thing, right?
When in doubt, blame Brian. That's my motto with this show.
Well, that is usually correct. I was trying to remember, actually, how did we first connect?
I think it must have been through Ben Lilly.
That's probably true, yeah.
Yeah, but I can't remember. But that's how whole great relationships start, right? You never quite remember how you first meet the person.
I think about that a lot, actually, because, you know, I have all these dear friends, and there are a couple of them that I can really pinpoint. Like, so one, Dan from Ninja Sex Party, dude sent me a cold email, and I know the date. I believe it was February 18th, 2009. Like, there's literally a thing where I can point to it and say, this is where that friendship started. Layton, we can kind of put a date, or at least a time frame, because you were on a computer talking to Vernon, and you know,
you helped us come up with puns, band related coffee puns.
Yes, for their video game Dream Daddy, there was a coffee shop, and they wanted indie band themed coffee puns, and the only one I remember was "Godspeed You, Black Coffee."
Yeah. But, and I'm pretty sure that was a Vernon one. I think was Froyo Latengo.
No, that was me. That one was me. That one was definitely me. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay. I'm not sure I buy it, but yeah. Froyo Latengo was good of you.
That was me?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I don't remember that at all. Yeah. But anyway, I was thinking, I have so many people in my life that, you know, I love dearly, and I can't fucking remember how we met. What was that contact? You know, when I was off on our relationship by 4 years.
I mean, I think that's a good segue because when I think about that, for many of my friends now, those friendships, most of them originated on the internet, especially the twilight years of my teens spent being
on
Tumblr.
When you were reading Twilight.
Shut up. When I was on Tumblr constantly, you know, I have friends that I've known for over a decade now that I met writing and reading Portal 2 fan fiction on Tumblr. And I feel like that. In reading your book, I was thinking about that a good bit.
Yeah, they're real friends. Like,
oh yeah,
I have lots of conversations with people where we sort of say things like that, and they're like, they're somehow different, and it's like they're not. Do you like this person? Do you get on? Do you have interest? Then it's a real friendship.
Yeah,
you've never seen their lower half. You don't know how tall they are. You don't know their last name, but you're besties, and that's how it goes.
To be honest, I don't think I've seen the lower half of most of my friends, and I kind of want to keep it that way.
Yeah. It's usually the less flattering half.
Yes,
indeed. Well, I think we should, just to set the scene up front. So, Pete, you alluded to a book, and you were nice enough to send Layden and I. Look, we don't just have to talk about the book. The problem is the book's so interesting that I do want to talk about it extensively. We can talk about other things, and it wouldn't be this show if we didn't segue into whatever the fuck we're going to do. Can you just say a few words about your new book, which just came out, and what, you know, general topic and, you know, whatever you want to say about it?
I can do. I've got a copy here. It's a good mirror, but here we go. There we go. It's called Unlocked: The Real Science of Screen Time and How to Spend It Better. And it's, well, it kind of does what it says on the tin, really. It's about screen time. For me, it was about writing a corrective to a lot of the conversations and a lot of the panics that are happening in the media around this general concept of screen time, which is this really weird thing, right? Because everybody knows what screen time is, but it isn't actually anything. It's a completely meaningless concept, right? And we're all worrying about it. And some people are really worrying about it, and some people are, I think, stoking some real fears there. And it just seems like a real shame to me because, you know, it's all about being online and, you know, using smartphones and social media and stuff like that. And there are some really difficult questions to ask there and really important things that we could be taking the industry to task about. And we're not, because we're freaking out about bogeymen, basically.
Yeah.
Big top line, scary things that just don't make sense to ask. Yeah. So the book was like, okay, let's just get all of that out of the way. Here's what the science says about these things. It's a mess. These are not the right sorts of questions to worry about. These are the things that you might want to think about instead. And, you know, if you are worried about your own screen use, this is how you could do something about that, basically.
Yeah. I was thinking about your book, and I feel like, you know, there's so many, like every page has something on it where I was like, oh my God, that's so interesting. But in general, I feel like I can summarize the basic point of the book in four words, which is, don't panic, it's complicated.
Yeah, which is kind of unsatisfying, right?
But is always the answer, pretty much. This is, you know, I don't need to tell you, the number one thing about science communication and talking to people about science is everything interesting is complicated. There's very rarely a simple narrative. And yet every fucking thing you read is, like you say, this one weird trick, right? This one weird psychological trick that's going to make everything better, you know, and it's never right. Or even if it's like kind of right, like you say, I forget exactly where later in the book, you know, it applies only to this kind of one type of person in this one situation under certain circumstances, and then maybe it works some of the time, you know?
Yeah, we always have these like two paths with answers to everything, right? It's either easy but wrong, or difficult but complicated. And nobody likes the difficult but complicated route. We all like easy things to digest, and I understand that. Nobody's got time, right? Nobody's got time to wade through the science and try and figure out what the evidence base is for something.
Yeah.
So we rely on heuristics. We rely on rules of thumb and just easy stories. We rely on things that fit with our own experiences and our own feelings. And I think everybody's got an anecdote about spending too much time on Instagram, looking at cat GIFs or whatever, right? So when somebody comes along and says, these things are really quite bad for you, it's true. That slots quite easily into our worldview. And if somebody else comes along and goes, hang on, it's not quite like that, we tend to be a bit more skeptical. But we kind of need to be critical of both, really, and open to all.
Absolutely. I underlined several things that I feel like I need to get out of the way. Because, okay, my favorite thing about this book is not the content of the book. It's that finding out things that you and I personally have in common. And I'm like, oh, there's something I didn't know about my friend. Number one thing, we have to talk about Bluey, because Bluey is the best thing ever. And I have been watching it with my family extensively. We just started a few months ago. And it is, I think, the Unicorse episode may be one of the funniest episodes of TV I have ever seen. We quote it constantly around this house. So I have to ask Layton, as a Gen Zer, a Zoomer, if you will, do you know what Bluey is?
Of course I know what Bluey is.
Okay, I've
watched some Bluey, but it's not really my zone. Nobody's getting murdered in it, so
well,
it's kind of not
in the
my
foreground
lane.
Yeah. But it's the best, right?
It is. It is. Have you spotted any of the continuity stuff across episodes?
No, I haven't.
There's tons of stuff in there for parents. So like the tiniest little detail that happens in one episode will get picked up in the background like five or six episodes later. So there's an episode where there's a busker and Bluey goes over and gives them some money. It gives them a note that's got a drawing on it. I think it was drawn by Bingo. Mm-hmm. And then like 10 episodes later, you see in the background the busker using that money at an ice cream stand to buy an ice cream.
Oh my God.
Or something. And you like zoom in and it's the same one because it's got the same drawing on it and stuff like
that's
that.
That's so great.
I love stuff like that.
It's so smart. The show it's smart. It is genuinely funny.
Yes.
Like, yeah. I mean, laugh out loud. You know, not all of it, of course. It's touching when it's touching. You know, it's just, it is legitimately, as you say, like, everyone in the family can love it. Rachel and I love it. Audrey loves it. We just talk about it all the time. I've talked to other friends, friend of the show, Jim Roach, my producer. He's like, yeah, we started watching it with the family. And he's like, now my wife and I just watch it by ourselves because it's great. Yeah.
Yeah. Totally the same.
In the footnote where you mentioned Bluey being great, you mentioned that they have a good screen time episode. What's the conceit of that one in Bluey's world?
So I kind of hated it to begin with, but I've mellowed a little bit in my grumpiness around screen time messaging. So the idea is Bingo brings this toy home from school that is like, it's kind of like a show and tell thing. You got to take this toy around and take some photos with it that go in the scrapbook when she goes back to school after the weekend. And basically everybody's on their phones all the time. So Bob Bilby, that's his name, Bob Bilby.
Oh, yes, of course.
There's a photo of him like looking really sad while Bluey and Bingo are on the iPad in the background. And then, you know, it's like dad's on his iPad. And so like basically everybody's on all their phones and the parents kind of realize that this looks really sad and it's depressing for the inanimate toy to not have a good experience. So then they kind of all fix it at the end. But the nice thing about it for me, like on at face value, the episode is, you know, screens are bad. And when you stop doing things on screens, you have a good time.
Yeah, get out in the world, right?
Yeah, yeah. And that, yeah, that is a message there, I guess. But the nicer thing for me is that like how the parents deal with that situation, you know, they don't have this like epiphany and go, oh, we need to ban screens and they're super toxic and we really need to think about them. They've just gone, okay, you know, we've maybe overdone it a little bit today, the last few days. So let's go and do something different. And I think that's a really healthy approach to screen time. It's not to vilify it, certainly not for kids to go, this is this magical, scary thing that you shouldn't have. It's only for parents kind of thing, and, you know, mysticize it. But, you know, just be open about everybody's use and just catching yourself when you're overdoing it and not beating yourself up about it, but thinking, well, what can I do better next time?
Generally, the show is so thoughtful and compassionate, too, that's totally, you know, that's their whole vibe, right? With everything they do is it's very humane and not too judgy about various things, right?
Yeah, I do worry that like the dad bandit is like a super dad.
Oh, tell me about it. I can't live up to that.
No. And sometimes my daughter watches it and she wants to recreate the episode and mm-hmm. play the games that they play. And I'm like, I can't do this. I'm too tired.
Oh, like the octopus game, the one where he's the octopus.
Yeah.
Right. So Layton, the conceit here is he's kind of an octopus. He's like the fun dad. They have to get from one side of the catch to the other. He's like reaching over and grabbing them. And I mean, unless you have really long arms, it's very hard to actually do that in practice. But also there's no way that's going to be as fun as it seems in the show. Yeah. Yeah, which is kind of the point of the episode to some extent, but
I mean, there's similarly like scaremongery type things about how Bluey is, you know, causing bad behavior in children. Like that was my primary exposure to it for a while. It's just that like, causing children to act out.
What?
Do not let your children watch Bluey. Yeah. I mean.
To do what? I mean, of course it's a thing. So someone's mad at it, but like, I wonder what the precise complaint was?
No, which is really helpful of me, I know, but I don't really generally pay more than a passing interest in children's television and adults being angry about children's television. That's not really my bag.
I mean, the kids seem like pretty normal kids to me, but what the hell do I know?
Yeah.
I read an article like a year ago that was like this academic deconstruction of the dad as actually being this really toxic masculine figure. Uh-huh. I just read this thing, and it's, you know, when you read articles and you think, that is 5 to 10 minutes of my life that I will never get back.
Yeah.
And nobody can pay me for that. And it was one of those things, it's just like absolutely po-faced. You know, you're talking about a talking cartoon dog.
Yes.
We can read into this too much.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a kid's show. Each episode is like 12 minutes long. We're going to be okay. Yeah. Another thing I'm very excited to talk about is Cryptic Crosswords, because I love Cryptic Crosswords. And
amazing.
As you probably know, there's a big difference between British cryptics and American cryptics, right?
No, I don't know this.
Oh, dude.
I also don't know this.
Okay. It is a whole thing.
He's so excited. Look at him.
I'm
Holy
so
shit.
Excited. I never get to talk about Cryptic Crosswords. Layton is not quite a fan, right? Is that fair?
I don't care.
I don't want to speak for you, but here, no, shut up. I'll talk for you for a second.
Yeah.
We occasionally will talk about it. We'll do a crossword for a mini episode for this show. And I have occasionally suggested cryptic crosswords, but you're less into them, right? Is that fair to say?
I like suffering. I don't like suffering that much.
Right.
Well, also like making jokes and stuff. Like all tracks of my brain are occupied already with a regular crossword without all this extra shit on top. I mean, cryptic.
So the difference between, roughly speaking, there are many different styles of cryptics, but the difference between British and American cryptics, roughly, is that American cryptics have kind of more rules and they're like standard sort of things that they adhere to. And British cryptics are very free flowing to the extent where someone called one particular one, what is it, the Spectator that has like a particularly famous one? I can't even remember.
Yeah. I mean, they all have their different vibes, right?
Yeah.
So,
right.
Like one of the things that I didn't say about in the book was that like, I taught myself how to do it and I used this app, and this app was great because it really properly taught you how to use it. Mm-hmm. And by the end of it, I was like, do you know what? I'm shit hot at this thing now. and like the first cryptic crossword that I picked up was from the Times or something like that.
Yeah.
I don't know if I even understood the words that they were using.
And
that's
it just
really, really bummed me out. So back to the drawing board. So there are definite tiers of style and difficulty.
Yeah. And especially with British cryptics, like they have no problem using a word that no one has ever looked up in the OED, but it's there and you could like find it if you really tried. And it's a lot more just like freewheeling, kind of like, you know, hey, let's figure it out. So in American cryptics, for example, there is a general consensus. If you're going to hint at an anagram, it has to be an anagram of the letters on the page, not for like a synonym on the page. So
okay.
I forget exactly what the term is, like direct anagrams or something like that. So if you wanted to anagram, I don't know, evil and live, you wouldn't say, you know, mixed up bad.
Right.
You
know, okay.
To get live. Yeah. It would have to be like mixed up evil or whatever. So it is generally considered bad sportsmanship to do that sort of thing in America. And I don't think that's quite as stringent in the UK, for example.
Yeah, some of them are mean.
Some of them are fucking really mean. Nasty. Yeah, they're torturous.
You try and cheat and look at the answers and you find the answer and you're like, I still have no fucking clue what's going on.
Yeah.
Like none of this makes sense.
Yep. So I grew up with American cryptics. Games Magazine had a famous cryptic by a cryptic crossword power couple, Emily Cox and Henry Ravthon. Am I saying those names right? I think I am. Married couple that were longtime cryptic constructors, Cox and Ravthon. And, you know, I learned the rule. It's one of those things. It's exactly what you said where, so we should say what it is for people who don't know. Generally speaking, a cryptic crossword is tell me if this is your conception of it as well, is it looks like a kind of normalish crossword grid, but every clue has a kind of tricky wordplay part and then an actual definition. And the goal is to try to suss out what's the tricky part and what's the synonym of the word being clued. Maybe yeah. That's less true in British cryptics, but that's what it is in Americans.
No, I think that's accurate. I think, you know, the general idea is that if you look at a clue, there's like the literal reading of the clue and it'll be completely nonsensical. It won't tell you anything about the final answer. But what you're going to do is completely deconstruct the clue to figure out what it actually is that they're asking for. So, you know, when you see words like mixed up or confused, that's like an indicator that there's an anagram of something, right?
Right.
And usually it's the case that there's like one word at the start or at the end of the clue that is the actual clue. Right. And then the rest, you've got to kind of deconstruct to figure out what it's telling you about how to create the word.
Yeah.
So yeah, I got super obsessed with them. A, when I was writing the book, and B, when my son was born a couple of years ago. So I ended up, I was writing this chapter about sleep for the book and, you know, whether screens kill your sleep. And I don't know, it seems a bit weird now. Like, I wrote some cryptic crossword clues to stick into the book. And it seemed like a really fun, quirky, cool idea at the time. And now I look back and I'm like, what was I on when I was doing that? It's a really weird thing to do, Pete.
I did not stop and try to figure them out, actually. Do they have answers? There are like answers?
They do have answers. Okay. They do have answers.
Oh, wow.
But those answers are not published in the book. Is that correct?
They're not. And there's a common theme amongst the answers as well.
Well,
so.
Now we need the bonus where Brian figures them out.
Yeah.
I had this grandiose plan where I was going to do this sort of weird, multi-layered advertising campaign for the book that would like start off with people trying to figure out. Basically, I'd read Ready Player One again. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, these could be the gates and the keys and shit. So stage one is figure out the answers to the clues, and then you'll type them into a website and that will unlock another thing to do. And then I realized that all of that needs time and effort and money. And I don't have any of those.
Yeah.
So they're just there. They're just clues with no answers. And because I wrote them when I was slightly sleep deprived, I keep going back to them and I'm not quite sure that I know the answers anymore either. There's definitely like one of them that I'm like, ah, I think it's this, but I'm not sure.
How long did it take you to write this book from start to finish, like research included?
Too long. I started writing it in 2020. So that like the first chapter, I sort of talk about my daughter toddling around. That's the thing. Like you can sort of see how long it's taken because my kids grow up in it. So it starts off with like Matilda being like 6 months old. And at the end of the book, she's four. So 2020 was when I started. And then it took a while to kind of get the pitch worked up and refined. And, you know, it takes time to get a publisher and all of those sorts of things.
Yeah.
So I'd probably written about a chapter. It took me about 2 years to write a chapter and do all of that stuff. And then for the rest of it, I really hit the ground running in like January 2022. Uh-huh. So I wrote the entire thing in like 9 months. So chapters two to the end, basically.
Right.
And then there was like another 6 months of rewriting it because it was terrible, which is what always happens with books.
Well, and especially like a book where you're trying to be accurate. Right. This is not just sit down and write a novel, which is also hard, but for different reasons. The whole point is like, be careful about what you're saying. Right.
Yeah. And there've been a few times with this book where I had that like really real like crisis of confidence and just gone, you know, have I just like got this completely wrong? You know, is it the case that I've just completely misread all of the science in this area and I'm saying that everybody's wrong and actually they're right and I'm just going to make myself out to be a complete idiot in quite a public fashion. Mm-hmm. I don't think I am.
Oh,
so true. I try and be kind of humble about it throughout the book. But it's a weird one. I mean, I think there's things in there that I sort of built up a bit of confidence by the time I got to like chapter seven, and chapter seven is on digital addictions. And I remember not knowing how to start that chapter and getting really pissed off with myself and then going, ah, screw it. I'm just going to write, you're not addicted to your phones. Full stop, done, chapter.
Yeah,
move on to
great.
The next one.
Yeah.
And then I took it out and then I put it in and took it out. And I kept like, eventually I was like, no, I'm going to keep that in because I know not everybody's going to agree with that. And yeah, there are researchers that won't agree with that. Sure. But also, I think I'm right. And it was the chapter that I was the most nervous about in terms of, have I got this completely wrong? And it's weird because it's the one that people who've read it so far and like other psychologists who've read it have gone, yeah, you're actually bang on there. That's it's nice. It's nice to actually see somebody say that out loud because we just assume that it's true and it's not.
Yeah, I think in a word, I would describe the book as refreshing.
Yeah.
Also not a pun. But just I've...
Come on. That was a pun, Layden. Come on.
That would have been a great name for a great title. I really struggled with the title for the book and ChatGPT did not help.
Asking ChatGPT for titles for stuff is always... it's like, oh, it's cute that you tried.
Yeah.
But then also like, oh, but I can't do better than this either.
Yeah.
Yeah. The book was originally called Screens Are Not Your Enemy, which I wrote in a huff because I was fed up with everything. Mm-hmm. And it was the title that sold the book because I think obviously it's quite a controversial title. And I think it sold it for the publishers. But then they were like, you can't call it this because it will annoy people to the point that they won't buy your book. Which is fair enough. If you're very anti-screens, you're not going to buy that book, right?
If the goal when you're making something is to not annoy people, I have been approaching my entire career incorrectly.
No, I absolutely want to annoy people, but I want them to buy the book first. Yeah, so right. I might get halfway through before people get annoyed. If you're not annoying people, then you're doing it wrong, right?
Oh, I could not agree more.
I remember when I was writing for The Guardian, because he used to run the blog network there. Right. And their motto was to entertain, enrage, and inform, which I always liked.
Yikes. That's,
wow. I like that. Enrage.
Yeah.
Can you remember a specific thing other than the thing you talk about in the book, your own Stephen Hawking thing? Was there a time that someone got particularly angry, or not someone, but a piece really pissed people off?
Yeah, I have so many stories about that. So I nearly got sued about 10 years ago. So I wrote this article about neuromarketing. And neuromarketing is this idea that sort of standard marketing might be something like you ask people to try a new drink and then for like $5, fill out this questionnaire. How did you feel about this drink? And it's a self-report problem, right? It's those kind of what I talk about in the book, this problem with, you know, people might say that they really like that drink, but they might actually properly hate it, but they feel like they have to say that they like it because, you know, you've given them a free drink and $5.
Sure.
So the idea behind neuromarketing is that you can get around that. So you kind of do brain scanning and stuff like that when people are actually trying the drink. And then you know what's going on in their brain. Did they actually like it or not? It's this sort of complete nonsense area. I love it because it's built on this like really interesting idea that came about in the research literature about, well, 15 years or so ago, 15 or so years ago, which is this. There was a really great paper called The Seductive Allure of Neuroscience or Neuroscience Explanations. And basically the idea behind the article was that if you sort of put stuff about the brain in anything, people are more likely to pay attention to it and buy into it because people like brains because everybody's got brains. So they did this study where you give people a description of a psychological phenomenon. So the one that I always remember is the curse of knowledge. So there's this study where you take a bunch of facts and you know that 50% of the population know these facts, right? So you then give these facts to people and say, do you know this or not? So I don't know, like London's the capital of England. Do you know this or not? Yes or no. And then you ask them, how many other people do you think know this fact? And basically what you find is that if you know a fact, you overestimate how many other people you think know it. Mm-hmm. So it's called the curse of knowledge because people superimpose their beliefs and their knowledge on everybody else. Right. So you give people that description and then you give them an explanation and the explanation's either good or bad. So good explanation is kind of what I said there. And bad explanation is this curse of knowledge happens because people over-report stuff that they think they already know, which is like a circular redefinition of the thing itself.
Yeah.
So you get a bunch of those and you ask people, how satisfied are you with this explanation, right? And people are generally really satisfied with the good explanations and really unsatisfied with the bad explanations. But then the key manipulation was that they also put irrelevant neuroscience in there sometimes. So mm-hmm. sometimes you maybe get an explanation that was like, the curse of knowledge happens because brain scans indicate that the frontal lobes activate when people blah, blah, blah. So you're literally just adding brain words into this. It doesn't add anything to the explanation. And if you do that for a bad explanation, people suddenly find it really satisfying. Mm-hmm. So I think it's kind of this like heuristic thing that people go, ooh, brain stuff, that must be right.
Yeah.
So neuromarketing is like that, but marketing.
So that means adding brain words into advertisements to make them seem like, more scientifically factual.
Yeah, or doing this sort of like maybe like an advertising campaign where you say, we scanned people's brains and it shows this fundamental thing. So there was this advert that came out at the time. I won't name the company just in case they decide to sue again. And basically what they did, it's really hard to because it's part, like it was a car company. And what they did was this experiment where they got a bunch of people into the lab, and the lab looked very strangely like some sort of boardroom. Mm-hmm. At a marketing company, and they put an EEG system on their head. So EEG measures electrical brain activity, right? EEG is really cool. It's also very difficult for various reasons because, you know, your brain is an electrical thing, but so is your scalp. Your brain's quite leaky. So, you know, electrical activity kind of emanates out of your head. So the idea is you stick some sensors on your head and you can measure electrical activity underneath that sensor and infer that that part of the brain is doing something when you do whatever, right? You do some sort of experiment, right? But you can't do things like, say, which part of the brain underneath it and all of those sorts of things. It's very difficult. You can get some like off-the-shelf EEG systems, which are literally just like two sensors that go on your forehead, right? Mm-hmm. That will measure something, but, you know, your muscles conduct electricity as well. So if you kind of start moving your eyebrows around, it will pick that up as well. Mm-hmm. Anyway, simple system. And you get a bunch of men and women into this experiment and you show them a bunch of videos. So they show them things like, they showed them videos of babies crying, videos of babies laughing, videos of like really crappy old cars, and videos of like really cool super duper concept cars mm-hmm. from this company. And what they found in this super duper study was that women showed the most emotional response to the crying baby videos, and men showed the most emotional response to the super duper concept car. Therefore, what women want in good car design is something that will protect their children. And what men want in good car design is something that looks and drives really smooth. And Company X fulfills all of those sorts of things.
Oh, boy. Is,
yeah, right. It's fun on a number of levels.
So not only are they reinforcing the gender binary, they're also doing so to make stupid cars.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. I don't know if actually it had anything to do with making the car itself. So I think it was like... The tagline was good car design is on a par with basic human emotion. Ugh. Something like that. And, you know, brain imaging studies that show this, right? And I just saw it and I was like, nah, I got to say something about this, and called it out. And it's basically like, this is crazy, right? And it comes from a long pedigree of these sorts of sciencey looking things.
Yeah.
Or, you know, non-science, pseudoscience being dressed up as science for the sake of advertising. It's sort of like the same ilk as, so in the book I talk about Blue Monday, which is a made up thing.
But I'd never heard of that before your book.
This is a problem, right? So I think now Blue Monday primarily exists because skeptical scientists keep telling everybody that it doesn't exist.
So, and also, I guess, Vonnegut, Goodbye Blue Monday, et cetera.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, true.
Yeah. It's become a zombie thing that... But, you know, you see things like, you know, scientists invent formula for the perfect chocolate or something like that. And that will come out around Valentine's Day. Or scientist shows formula that shows that chocolate's better than kissing and it comes out on Valentine's Day, things like that.
Yeah.
So I kind of called it out. And I remember at the time being very nervous. Like, I'm generally quite risk averse when it comes to writing stuff because I'm very conscious about libel.
That's right, because you guys have stricter or weirder libel laws than we do.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
It's guilty until proven innocent in the UK, and in the US, it's the opposite, essentially, right?
It's better now than it was 10 years ago. Yeah. But yeah, very much the case at the time that, you know, if somebody thought that you had libeled them and they sue you, then it's up to you to show that you've not, rather than for them to show that you have. So there have been a lot of cases, particularly around science blogging, actually, in the UK.
Yeah, Simon Singh is the big one that I think I've read.
Yeah, the classic. It's been weaponized, basically, to try and silence people. So that was all happening. So I was very kind of conscious of that. So I ran this piece past the Guardian's legal team, which we could do if we wanted to. And they suggested like a little tweak. And it was one sentence, and I'd said something like, you know, in all of these cases that I've shown, it's just marketing or nonsense dressed up as science. You know, it's nonsense. And they said, that's your personal opinion, which was true. So you need to make it clear. So, and it's literally just, you need to say, it seems as though, or it feels as though. Anyway, so I published this piece, and the marketing company that did that car thing, the managing director emailed me and like was very, very angry about it all. And threatened to sue, you know, and, but sort of like in an indirect way. So he was upset that we'd basically, or that I'd said that neuromarketing's a load of crap. But he sort of, in a roundabout way, threatened to sue me because he said, we've also done work with big insurance companies, and I'm sure they would be unhappy if they found out that you were questioning our methods, you know, and them by association. And unofficially, I'd suggest that you don't want to get involved with big insurance companies' lawyers. I kind of laugh about it now, but it was quite scary at the time.
Yeah, of course.
That's very much like, those are some nice kneecaps you've got there.
Be ashamed. Be ashamed if you couldn't get a home insurance policy.
You know? Yeah. Funny you say that, actually. That's been a problem the past few years. But I felt at the time, you know, if this was just a blog that I was writing and publishing myself, I would be bricking it, and I would have taken it down, that blog post, in a moment's notice, and groveled as much as, because I didn't want to get sued. And thankfully, like, The Guardian had my back on this. So I kind of went to my editor and I said, what do I do about this? And he said, let's just run it past the legal team. And it was incredible. Like, the legal team sent him this very, very polite, legally worded fuck off, which I really appreciate.
I love a good lawyer fuck off.
It was great. But in and amongst the code to that, I guess, and it's something that's stuck with me for 10 years, is that in and amongst all of that, the conversations that I was having with this guy, he can kind of get bouncing between good cop and get bad cop. Mm-hmm. He'd like put these like low level threats in, and then he'd say things like, you know, you should come along and see what we actually do. And, you know, I'd love for you to do all that stuff. And then try to justify it. And he said, you know, you've said this as though we're like doing actual science, and that's not the purpose of what we're doing here. We're not about providing the signal. We're about providing the noise. And I was like, yeah, that's what I wrote in the blog.
That's the problem.
It was brilliant. Anyway, it all went away, but it was really not nice for a while. That kind of feeling and you know, sort of thinking at night, you know, if the Guardian decide not to support this, you know, what's going to happen then? Because, you know, in those sort of situations, you can either sue the newspaper or you can sue the writer.
Right.
And that's what happened with Simon Singh, right? That they, I can't remember who it was, but they went after him as a writer.
I'm getting the name of the organization wrong. It was like the British Chiropractors Association or something like that. And as I recall, he said chiropractic medicine is bogus. And they singled out the word bogus as an attack or libel or whatever. And he, you know, he said it, as I recall, in a pretty level-headed way. And it was, you know, it was just like a statement of, according to these studies, well, it doesn't work, blah, blah, blah. And they went after him for years. Like, this went on forever. So I think it was the British Chiropractors Association or something.
He won eventually.
Like, yes, he did.
And I think that's what precipitated a change in an easing of the libel laws. But yeah, it's made me chuckle, and it's always made me think very carefully about the words that I use, because it's really important, right?
Yeah,
you can inadvertently say things that you may well just mean it as an opinion, but it comes across as you saying something factual, and you get in a lot of trouble very easily.
Yeah.
I think totally. That story is a good example of the sort of like personal stakes that people attach to certain conclusions that come from studies or research, which I think you touch on really well in this book. Of, you know, my whole thing is screens are bad and they're going to kill your children. So everything that I do, it behooves me to continue to do speaking engagements and get more book deals, et cetera, to keep hammering this drum, even in the face of any reasonable person. So I very much appreciate the links that you go to in this book to dispel a lot of the very clickbaity, scaremongering stuff, because I have read a lot of the books that you mention as bad examples of this. And they always hit a little weird because it does feel, in comparison, your book just feels so like reasonable.
That's really kind of you. I had like this proper, almost like existential crisis when I was writing it, because it was really hard, because what I was trying to do is be as evidence-based as possible about the things. And so there's a chapter on sleep in particular, you know, does blue light from screens impact on sleep? And the answer to that should be yes, in theory, like from a purely physics-based perspective.
Yeah.
You know, it's not controversial to say that blue light impacts sleep. It definitely does. But then if you look at the research on like iPhones and tablets and stuff, it's just not very good. But what happens is like you read some of these other books that are really beautifully written, like the very good story crafters, the people that write them, and they tell a very cogent story about a particular paper. And then I go away and find that paper and read it. And I was always like, am I reading the wrong thing here? Because this is completely different. But even like to this, I remember there was one paper in particular, and it's in that chapter. And even like in the abstract of that paper, it's basically blue light from screens is bad for sleep.
Yeah.
But then you read what they did and the results that they found, and the results are completely different. The results show that actually like nothing's going on.
Yeah.
And then they pivot in the discussion. They go, yeah, there's a trend here. So there's a trend towards this being bad, and therefore it must be significant. So it's definitely bad. It's like this slippery slope that they wanted to find this. They didn't quite, but they changed that narrative anyway. And then somebody else comes along and just reads the abstract and goes, this paper shows definitively that screens are bad. And I think that's the one consistent thing that I see happen in this space, is that you will get battered with, but this study shows this. And what happens there is that you need to spend quite a lot of time and energy looking at that study and going, hang on, what did they actually show here?
Right.
There's like some study that's out at the minute that apparently like is commissioned by, it's not like a proper published scientific study. It's like a commissioned report type thing. But it says definitely there's maybe causal evidence that screens are bad for mental health and stuff. And you're like, oh, God, well, have I actually got it wrong? And here's the smoking gun study. And then you read it and it's like, well, we asked people at what age they started using their phones. And then we asked them how they feel now. And those two things are really strongly correlated. Like the earlier you started your phones, the worse you feel now. It's like, that's not science. That doesn't tell you anything, right? That's not how we do science. That's how you answer that question. But scientific study, blah, blah, blah.
At some point in the book, I can't remember where, you point out something that I'd never really considered, but is so obvious in one sense, where you're like, yeah, the older you get, you just have like more responsibilities and kids and shit, and things get harder. Maybe you're less happy because you have a fucking child now, and that's difficult, you know, which is such a good point. You know, it's one of these control things that you mentioned, which things like that just plain don't take into account, right?
It's the attention stuff, right? Yeah. And I think this is something that comes up a lot when I talk to people about not just this book, but this whole topic generally, that people are really worried about like concentration and attention spans and things like that. And you know, I have a lot of conversations with my students about this, that they really struggle. And it's really hard not to go, well, everybody's worrying about this. Phones everywhere.
Yeah.
There's got to be something there, right?
Right.
And that idea forms the basis of a lot of arguments that a lot of prominent people have put forward over the past few years, that these things are kind of completely destroying our attention. Genuinely, I went into this thinking, this is all BS, but then do the research and go, oh, hang on, there is something here. And I was fully expecting
being a scientist,
to happen
right?
At some point.
That's what
there was
going
to be a chapter in there somewhere where I go, hang on, this thing, we're onto something here. And it just didn't really happen. And the attention stuff was very much like that. Because, I mean, I kind of say it in the book that attention is one of those things that, like, psychology students, like, they all learn about in year one.
Yeah.
So you think we know a lot about it. And in a way we do. You know, there are literally tens of thousands of papers on attention out there. But there's this, like, weird existential crisis going on in the research literature at the minute, that you get in, like, this increasing number of studies or papers with titles like, nobody knows what attention is. Please help. I'm in attention prison. I can't figure out how to get out. Can we stop talking about attention now, please?
Like many things in science, it somewhat suffers from being a vernacular term, right? We kind of know what attention is, but once you start using vernacular in a what's supposed to be a precise way, you can get into a lot of trouble really fast because you feel like, yeah, you know what it means, but you need to be specific, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's like the jingle jangle problem stuff that you talk about in the book.
Yeah.
Do you want to say what that is?
In some cases, it's using one term to mean lots of different things. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we might use the term well-being when sometimes we mean depression, sometimes we mean being happy, sometimes we mean something completely different. So those are all very different constructs, but they're assumed to all be the same thing because you use this catch-all term for them. Yeah. And then the jangle problem is the opposite, which is that you use lots of different terms when actually you're referring to the same thing. Mm-hmm. Right? So social media, social networking site, even like Facebook, WhatsApp, they're all very different things, but they might all map onto one particular construct. Yeah. Particular idea, but you're making out as though they're all different things. That's the big problem in the area, is that you see lots of different studies showing different things, right? So some studies show that screen time is good for mental health, some bad, some don't show anything. Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad. But there actually, I don't think there is a study out there that's looked at the impact of screen time on mental health in that generalized sense. It's always defined in a much more specific way and then assumed to be screen time. And then that's also true for mental health as well. A lot of people talk about mental well-being in this space. What is mental well-being?
Yeah.
Well, for some people it's life satisfaction. Some people it's happiness. Some people it's, you know, literally things like suicidal ideation, yeah, and things like that. And these are all very different things. So of course you're going to find different things when you measure all of them separately.
I can't remember if we talked about this last time you were on the show. My sense of a lot of people in social sciences, would you call what you do social science or not?
I don't know.
I always feel like with psychology, it's kind of a borderline thing sometimes, right?
Yeah.
Maybe yes, yeah. Maybe not. Probably depends on who you are. Anyway, with a lot of social scientists, I get the sense that people are told math exists. They get a computer program. They plug a bunch of shit into it. Something comes out and they're like, well, yeah, there it is. Mm. Without a deep understanding, and I think you're one of the notable, yeah, exceptions to this, without a deep understanding of what statistics is and, yeah, what it means and how it could go wrong, right? So yeah, you talk, yeah, about what the, you know, calling something a positive, you know, this is good evidence when it's like this teeny tiny positive correlation between two things. So my question is this an accurate assessment of a lot of people who are just, you're kind of given a box to throw some data into and then something pops out and you're like, yeah, cool.
It's literally how we teach it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So this, and it's a huge problem, right? I don't know whether it's the same in the US, but I know in a lot of UK universities, we're really struggling with this at the minute because we have like somewhere between 12 and 24 weeks to teach research methods and statistics.
Yeah.
Which is just not enough time.
No, it's it's an endless, literally an endless topic. You could get, yeah, you could base an entire career on just studying that one, yeah, thing. Right.
So when I was an undergrad, which was like over 20 years ago now, it was sort of the same. So we do things like analysis of variance and multiple regressions and things, yeah, like that. And we learned them by doing them by hand, right?
Yes.
So same. Learning the equations and then applying them. And then we were given the computer program, which is click this button, click that button, boom, you've got your analysis. And this is how we interpret the results. We don't do the first bit anymore.
Yes. Well, and the data sets have gotten a lot bigger too.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Yeah. So if you're not statistically minded and you're not the kind of person who's then going to go out and think and read and try and understand this off your own back, which, to be fair, is really hard.
Like, yes.
I'm not quite sure how people learn statistics well. And I mean like really good researchers and stuff. And I've tried to do this. Like, I wrote a paper a couple of years ago on loot boxes of video games, and it used Bayesian statistics.
Yeah.
So I taught myself Bayesian statistics. And I say taught in a sort of loose sense of the term, because it very much seems like one of those things that you either get or you don't. And there's always been a worry for me there that I think I've learned it, but actually I have no clue what I'm doing.
Well, and I think this has changed, but also for many years, Bayesian was considered bad by a lot of people. Like, if you weren't a frequentist, you were basically the devil. And I think the thinking on this has kind of flipped a lot recently.
Yeah.
In the last
10-ish years. There is a brilliant book coming out on this in about a month. Mm-hmm. I think so. It's by a friend of mine called Tom Chivers, who is like one of the best science journalists in the UK, if not the best. Yeah, so he's written a book called Everything is Predictable. And it's a little bit about the history of Bayes' theorem. A lot of the stories are quite wild about where this kind of theorem came from, mm-hmm. What it is, how it's applied, and all of those sorts of things. Yeah. So I would 100% recommend that.
I'd love to read that. For those of you listening who don't know, very roughly speaking, the debate is over when and how you should take priors into account when doing statistics. And Bayesians generally say, I mean, this is a vast oversimplification. Bayesians generally say, take those priors into account. Frequentists say, don't worry about them. That's not true. What I just said is a total lie, but in very broad brush strokes, that's kind of what it is.
What do priors mean in this situation?
So your prior beliefs about something. So what you kind of do with a Bayesian approach to stuff is go, you know, what is my pre-existing viewpoint? Let's collect some data. How does it change? How does it shift that prior belief, you know, for or against? So when you do this sort of statistics, or in kind of the way that I've done it in my research, it's not so much about finding whether there's a significant difference between two means or something like that. It's more about trying to find the strength of evidence for one hypothesis over another. So you kind of set up competing realities, basically. So one reality, loot boxes are really bad for people because it turns them into problem gamblers. And in another reality, it's not. So if you collect a load of evidence on people's loot box spending habits and their gambling habits, does it favor or support one hypothesis over another? So you can kind of set them up against each other. And so the evidence from our study was that there definitely is a correlation between loot box spending and problem gambling. So you get this statistic called the Bayes factor. So the Bayes factor tells you how likely is it basically that the evidence, the data that you've got, favors the hypothesis you were thinking about or not. And the general rule of thumb is if you get a Bayes factor of 100, that's really strong evidence for your hypothesis. It's basically saying it's 100 times more likely that this data happened because of your hypothesis rather than the null hypothesis. And the number that we got for finding that correlation between loot boxes and problem gambling was something like 1.85 times 10 to the 49.
Yeah. So I literally wrote down page 160 exponent on my notes here, because in physics, if you have a dimensionless number that big, something has gone very wrong. The first paper I ever wrote, we were just about to put it out, and then we checked something, and there was some number in it that came, it was like 10 to the 200, whatever it was. And my collaborator was an older scientist, at the time. He's like, we cannot put out a paper with this exponent in it. He's like, this is a crazy person who would write a paper with an exponent that big. And luckily, actually, we went back and we checked, and we had gotten something wrong. And indeed, we fixed it and it was fine, but look, I'll be honest. I read this book while taking a bubble bath this morning, and I almost dropped my iPad into the tub when I saw 10 to the, I think it was it 52 or 40, something like, yeah, it was a big number. Yeah. It was 50-ish, 10 to the 50-ish. And I was like, holy shit, that's a big number. So that's, it really stood out as like a, wow, that is, That is something you know beyond any, I mean, to say beyond any reasonable doubt, understates how certain that is.
Yeah, right? But it's also kind of so big it's meaningless as well. And
yes.
So interesting science communication failure here, actually. So what that number tells us, so the correlation between how much money you spend on loot boxes over the past month, or how much you report spending on loot boxes, and your problem gambling severity index score is 0.2. So it's quite a small positive correlation, right? Mm-hmm. What the 10 to the 50 number tells you is that it's 10 to the 50 times more likely that that correlation exists than it doesn't. Mm-hmm. So that correlation definitely is there.
But it doesn't say what the strength of the correlation is.
Tells you nothing about the strength of the correlation.
Right. Okay.
So what it's basically saying is that there's definitely a small, weak correlation between these two things, but it's not very big, right?
Yeah.
My life is really weird sometimes. And through complete happenstance, I found out the summer that this paper was published, it got brought up in Australian Parliament. So there's like this big debate about video games in Australian Parliament, and this this Australian MP came stood up and very, very strong feelings about how bad video games are. Mm-hmm. And he said, this new paper's just come out that shows that there is an extremely strong correlation between loot boxes and gambling, and it's absolutely there. It's so strong, it's causal. It's like that's not what we showed. That's not what that number means.
And it was the exponent that he was
looking basically at? It's because in that paper I talk about extremely strong evidence. This is extremely strong evidence in favor of the hypothesis, which is the technically correct way to explain what we did. Right. And it never really occurred to me when I was writing it that in sort of being so rigid scientifically about saying that could be completely misconstrued, right? If you don't know anything about stats and you see the words extremely strong evidence, then of course that's going to morph into this paper shows extremely strong evidence that loot boxes are bad for us.
Right.
And it's a very different thing.
But the correct statement is there's extremely strong evidence that there's some positive correlation.
Yeah.
But it says nothing. That's a relatively small correlation, but it doesn't say what the strength of the correlation is. Those two kind of unrelated numbers.
Loot box research is weird, right? Because that 0.2 correlation crops up pretty much every time somebody does a study in the area. And I probably hazard, well, I think it's because everybody's doing the same study.
Okay.
Because everybody asks, how much money have you spent on loot boxes? And everybody uses a scale called the Problem Gambling Severity Index. So it replicates really well. But it doesn't tell you anything about causality either. It doesn't tell you that loot boxes are causing problem gambling. So I worry a lot about the loot box research because in some ways, it's a brilliant area. Like, it's super open science. Everybody shares their data. Everybody makes all their code available. It's all really great on that front. But it's suffering potentially from the same cycle that I've seen with things like internet addiction. Mm-hmm. I fully hold my hands up and say I am a part of the problem here because I've done that study where I ask people how much money they spend and correlate it with problem gambling. Everybody basically does the same study because it's really hard to do anything else because what you actually need is actual data on how much money people have spent on loot boxes.
Yeah.
But then you get like 50, 100 papers published in the area. And then you start going, well, 100 studies, that can't be a coincidence. There must be something causal going on there. So that just sheer body of evidence is taken as evidence in and of itself that there's something wrong. And that's the wrong approach.
I was going to ask, actually, the money thing, I wrote down a question. I'm curious how much, if any, work has been done on this. It seems to me that there's kind of three different money situations. There's fully real cash, like the number on the screen is actually the money you're spending. If it says £10, you spend £10. Then there's the more common thing, which is you pay money to get virtual money. You pay real money to get virtual money, which then you spend. And then there's a version where it's just fully virtual. You spend no actual money or anything at all. Maybe it's not like you wait for the ad to clear and then you get, but it's like fully just virtual cash. This occurs to me, by the way, because I'm playing this game Balatro right now, which is like a kind of I talked about it. It's so fucking fun. Oh my God, I love it.
I think I've gotten like 4 Steam notifications as we've been recording that different people on my list are playing that game.
Yeah, it's great. But it's fully, there's cash in the game, but it's fully virtual, you know, it's just totally made up and use it in the game to buy like power-ups. It's kind of building a deck thing. So I was curious about those. I mean, I'm probably oversimplifying it, but the difference between a game where it's fully, I mean, very common in games, this happens in Stardew Valley, there are gambling things where you just spend fake money and you know, it's just fake. It still sucks to lose it, but I would imagine it's a different situation than actual real world money in the game. But I don't know, is it? Is kind of the question.
Yeah, no, definitely. So I think one of the earliest studies in this area actually looked at that and basically found that basically if you're opening up loot boxes for free, there doesn't seem to be any relationship with problem gambling. So it's the big thing is, are you spending money on it?
Real world money.
Real world money, whether it's like direct spend or like you say, it's buying currency and then then doing it. That's where you start to see these sorts of correlations. And then you see stronger correlations or weaker correlations depending on basically how gambling-like they look. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you've got like systems where you open up a loot box and you get something crappy, but then it goes, oh, here's what you could have won, something super shiny and amazing, then you see stronger correlations with problem gambling scores.
Yeah.
For obvious reasons, right? But yeah, there has to be a money element in there for it to show those correlations, I think. Nevertheless, I think people are still worried about, you know, even kind of free-to-play, free-to-access loot boxes and things like that, that there's something not right about them. But this is where the argument starts to fall down, really, because it starts to become a little bit puritanical in a way.
Feels like it has a moral dimension. Yeah.
So therefore, to be on the safe side, we should regulate it out of existence. And yeah, the game that you mentioned, you know, that's falling foul of that at the minute, right? Because I think when that first went on Steam, I think it had an age 3+ rating. Because, you know, it's kind of a fun card game, right?
It's poker. I mean, it is a modified version of poker, right?
But it's poker. So it's now been like slapped with an 18+ rating.
Has it really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's crazy to me.
But it kind of speaks to the difficulty that we have having these sorts of conversations and navigating them. What's the perceived versus actual, not even, you know, harm, it's like potential for harm with these things. And we've really not nailed down those answers yet.
I mean, you talk about it in the book too. This is obvious, you know, for me, the number one thing I think about with screen time is my kid. And it's such a hard question for all the reasons you get into. No one knows what the right answer is. There is no right answer, I think, actually is the answer. It's just very situational and, you know, there's a million different dimensions. But I think a lot about balancing my almost 10-year-old's screen time, less because of any moral dimension or me worrying that screen time itself is innately bad, which I know it's not, you know. Or I should say, I suspect it's not. But yeah, that, and also that kid identifies as a gamer. Like, she wears Minecraft pajamas every night. She loves Zelda. Like, this kid is 100% gamer. And that is such a big part of her identity. And certainly a way I think is awesome. Like, you know, it's not detrimental to her life in any way. She loves it. She's having a great time. Minecraft is so creative and fun. She plays it with her friends. You know, she's building stuff all the time. I think it's great. But I always think about this, you know, this sort of puritanical thing is going on in the back of my mind, which is like, am I a bad person for letting her play video games? I know the answer is no, but there's always that little twinge, right? Which is like,
I totally get it. That it's easy to have these conversations in a like, in a theoretical sense.
Yes.
Here and be like very clear that no, you know, that's absolutely fine. And then you get to the coal face, right? You know, you're there presented with that situation where, you know, your kid's going to have an iPad or whatever. And it's in those moments that you go, oh, shit, is this actually right?
Yep. We got her a tablet for Christmas. We got her own tablet, we're waiting. We have decided we're going to wait until very late to give her a phone, to give her a mobile phone, not because of screen time worries, but because it feels like it's better for her to not think about being on social media or whatever until she's 13 ish. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. So, there's a really big conversation going on in the UK at the minute around whether smartphones should be banned in primary schools. So from like ages like 5 to 12.
That's a big age range.
Yeah, it's quite a vitriolic argument as well. And it's totally understandable because it's a really emotive topic.
And I would think you would have people on both, like kind of both sides of the political spectrum spread out on that whole debate, right? It doesn't seem like a left versus right thing necessarily.
No, is that not true? I think everybody wants to be seen to be doing the right thing. Right. And it's a very much, you know, because we're talking about a think of the children situation. It's a very politically difficult thing to navigate. You know, I spoke to a journalist a few weeks ago, and it was rarely one of the very antagonistic conversations that I've had with a journalist about this. Well,
give us 5 minutes, Pete.
Well, I'm usually pretty good at not necessarily kind of convincing people of my viewpoint, but certainly just having a normal conversation about it. But it didn't really happen this time around. And it seemed very clear that, you know, they were writing this piece about it was going to be very pro-banning smartphones. Mm-hmm. And I got the impression that they'd been sent my book, but not really read it. Or like read like the first page and then gone, oh, Pete thinks everybody should have smartphones and they're fine. So it then became, I was really nervous that this article was going to come out and it was going to be like, here's all the reasons why kids shouldn't have smartphones. And then here's Pete Etchells, who hates kids. Pete, what do you think? It's really, really bad. But I was trying to say to her, like, you know, I've got a 4-year-old, right? And I'm nervous about these conversations with her about when she's going to have a smartphone.
Yeah.
I can't really see the need for her to have one for a long time.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm going to push back against that pressure because I just don't see the point. There might be a point where we get a flip phone if we want to keep in touch with her. Mm-hmm. But the absolute key thing for me is that she's going to get a phone at some point in her life.
You know,
it's going to happen because everybody has them, everybody uses them. And they're good things sometimes for some stuff.
And it's not that far away either, right?
And it's not that far away. No.
8-ish years away, something like who
knows? Yeah. So what needs to happen between now and that point is that we need to build digital literacy skills. So you know, whether she gets a phone at 7, 12, 18, 24, in a sense, it doesn't matter if phones have been completely isolated from the situation before that. You know, you can't have them, you can't try them out, you can't navigate them. It's going to be a bad experience because she's not going to know how to use it. So it's very much about demystifying them, explaining what they're used for, why we use them, why we want to use them, what we get out of them, having conversations eventually about like what apps are we happy with on there and what we're not. And,
yeah. You know. That's not even to say that then the actual stuff she's potentially seeing on those things. That's kind of a different conversation than if you're saying, you can watch YouTube. Well, that's a pretty vast ecosystem, right? Which is a separate, that's the conversation we're having with our daughter right now is here's why, you know, look, as a comedian, I have to say, look, Audrey, here's why this channel isn't funny. And anyone who thinks it's funny is a bad person.
Yeah. But that's exactly the kind of conversation to have, right? And it's about being open and non-judgmental about it and building those sorts of navigational skills almost around these ecosystems.
How did this interview go? How did it end up?
Oh, yeah. I want to hear about this.
So it happened on the Wednesday and the article was coming out on the Sunday and I spent the intervening time really worried about it and feeling like quite down about it. And then the article came out and I wasn't in it.
Oh, no.
They'd gone instead with a US researcher who apparently is the leading researcher in this area, who's basically like, yeah, screens are bad. They're going to melt your brains. So that was sad. I was kind of worried over nothing. But also I felt like it ended on a bad note as well. Like the last thing the journalist said to me was, and I, naively, I hope, that they meant it as a bit of like a tongue-in-cheek, lighthearted thing, but it didn't really come across as that. Like, you know, they said something like, let's have another conversation in 7 years' time when your daughter's come across something horrible on the internet. And I was like, I don't want her to.
Yeah.
I don't want that to happen. And I think, yeah, I think they meant it as sort of like, oh, you're being a bit naive about all this sort of stuff. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if you're already put off, and also it's good that, you know, the thing that you were worrying about didn't happen, but also feels so emblematic of the entire problem that you're exploring in the book.
Yeah.
If they picked somebody who reinforced the view screen bad, and that's the person who will continue to get contacted for press stuff and doing more things, because that is a popular, easy, you can put a nice little label on it, that this is bad.
Mm-hmm.
It's a consumable little nugget of information where, like, the thing that this book, you know, compared to reading other things like other books that you mentioned, like The Coddling of the American Mind, et cetera, where there's like, they are presenting a very specific problem. What comes out reading your book feels like, how the hell do we solve the problem of people misinterpreting research and that it's just completely accepted? Because I've never seen anybody else kind of tackle these other major, really popular pop psych things about screen time, to the point that if you didn't read your book or have somebody point it out, like, you wouldn't know that that stuff that is trotted out as being 100% accurate is actually bullshit. Like, how do we bridge that gap? If where it's like, for every single piece of like study show in the news, if you do like even the tiniest bit of due diligence, which is what most people are not going to do, it's like, well, that's not what it said. Hello?
Yeah.
Yes. And that's not even to mention a lot of the stuff you read online. And this is an endemic problem with science journalism, is the headline is written by someone who, like, an editor who, like, skimmed the article for 30 seconds, wrote some headline. Sometimes the headline is in direct contradiction to the main point of the article. Katie Mack was recently posting about something. Did you see this? Like, I can't remember what it was, but there was some article which was like, why the eclipse will kill you. And it's like, okay, calm down, you know? And the article was like, eclipses are fun. You know, it was, it was like literally the total opposite thing. Happens all the time. Any science journalist, I'm sure you've had this, Pete, you write something, some editor throws a headline on it, and you're like, oh fuck no. Why?
Yeah.
But it's exactly what you said, Layton. People don't do the due diligence. And I think to answer your question, what do you do, Pete? It's a hard answer, because the answer is better science education and media literacy, which we are generally not training people to do.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's a naively optimistic answer to this. And then there's maybe a quite dystopian, more realistic answer to it. So my naively optimistic answer is kind of like what you were saying there. I think we need to sort of shift people's, what people value. So I think one of the problems that's happened over the past 5 or 6 years is that we don't really value expertise anymore.
Right.
What we value is people who can say engaging things. Influencer space, basically, that, you know, if you're very good at kind of communicating with people, that's taken as value and taken as evidence that you know what you're talking about. Whereas your actual expertise has been devalued inadvertently, but also directly. Like, certainly in the UK, when Brexit happened, oh God, it was 8 years ago now.
That's crazy.
Shit,
that's right after I left was when the Brexit vote was.
It was your fault.
Brexit was about getting rid of Brian out of there.
Yeah, right. Yeah, people got confused. Well, I did say when I got on the plane to come back to move to LA, I screamed "Vote leave," and that was the last thing I said. Yeah.
But like Michael Gove, one of the MPs at the time, was you know, this newspaper article where he's like, "We've had enough of experts."
Yeah.
And what he was talking about was economic experts and, you know, people saying that Brexit would be a terrible idea, but it seemingly not to be based on evidence or anything like that. But that as a line as a feeling has been adapted. You know, it then got co-opted in the pandemic, like pro-vaccine and anti-vaccine people, right? And that, you know, if you were anti-vaccine, it's very much experts is a dirty word, right? It's somebody who's taken money from the Illuminati or whoever to inject a microchip into your bloodstream
The more unhinged version of that, which I do not understand anti-mask. Anti-vaccine, I can sort of get emotionally, you know, don't inject that into me. The anti-mask thing just seems completely insane to me. I fundamentally don't get it.
I think it's because it was a very overt signal of in-group, out-group status, right?
Yes.
So you don't 100%. Need to know anything about a person other than to see whether they've got a mask on or not. And you can identify them as part of your tribe or not.
Yeah.
Very easy thing to latch onto.
Yeah.
Hit the nail on the head. So you were saying your naively optimistic version of how to fix it. What's the dystopian one?
That we're not going to fix it. It's too late, basically. So that doesn't mean that it's all doom and gloom. I think it's more that with this argument, with this debate, it doesn't matter what we do or what we say. You know, even if my book was New York Times bestseller or whatever, and literally everybody read it, it would preach to the choir. You know, people who believe this would believe it more. People who were anti it would dig their feet in more. You're not going to change people because we're so deep into it now. But what will happen is that the technology will change. And because this is what always happens, right? Everybody was really worried about violent video games 10 years ago. And I don't think anybody is now.
Sure doesn't seem like it.
Yeah.
Bar a few people, a few researchers still fighting the good fight to show that they cause aggression. And, you know, your odd politician. I think most people have cottoned on to the fact that, you know, the good evidence shows that there's nothing to worry about. And it'll be the same with social media. We'll get over it. But there will be something else that comes after that, that we don't know what it looks like yet. It might be mixed reality stuff. It might be something that we can't even imagine yet. And the thing for me is that if we don't change the way that we think and talk and debate about these things, the same thing will happen in 10 years and in 20 years' time. And we'll just keep going through these cycles.
Because we always do. You point out the thing about the paper tax in the 19th century, right? Can you just briefly say what it was? Because I thought this was really cool.
So there was the repeal of the paper tax in the UK in the 1800s basically meant that it was a lot cheaper to print stuff. It coincided with this time where there was basically an explosion in mass paperbacks and magazines and penny dreadfuls and things like that. So up until that point, because books were expensive, basically, they were selectively for the elite, basically, and they're sort of seen as something that the masses couldn't engage in. And now we're in this situation where anybody can read anything. And everybody starts freaking out about it, right? That, you know, what are people reading? Is this going to, you know, young boys are going to read stories about highwaymen and robbers and stuff, and it's going to turn them into robbers, and it's going to destroy society. And I was talking to a historian called Matthew Sweet about it, and you know, he was telling me about it. He was a really interesting guy to talk to. And, you know, he was saying things like, you know, you look at some of the cartoons that were in newspapers at the time, and they'd like really evocative, like they'd be this picture of a woman with like a stack of books, like all these are all the books that she got for the month. And like, she'd just be like reading through them, like looking really haggard and disheveled. And they're like a couple of kids in the corner, like starving because their mother was neglecting them because she had to read her stories.
That was just a drawing of me.
There was I was reading in the just real quick in the book by past guest on the show, AJ Jacobs, The Puzzler. Similar thing happened with crossword puzzles about 100 years ago. Suddenly there's this massive explosion of crossword puzzles, and there are these endless articles about how, you know, we're going to shit because everyone's just solving crossword puzzles now, and this fad is destroying the world. You know, anytime there's a thing, right?
Yeah.
People get all up in arms about it.
It's new stuff. It's stuff that people don't understand because they've not been exposed to it enough or got their head around it enough. And yeah, you see it over and over again. So there's sort of a quote from Douglas Adams in the book that I use from Salmon of Doubt, which is basically like, anything that's invented when you're over the age of 35 is just against the natural order of things. Mm-hmm. Which I always love that. And I'm seeing it in myself now.
Oh yeah.
So I consider myself a fairly techie person, and you know, I've always been like an early adopter for things, and I love technology and I think it's great. I do not understand TikTok. I have tried.
You're in good company here.
It just doesn't make sense to me at all. Like, I can't figure it out, and it's new and scary and horrible. So, like, I've caught myself a few times going like, "Oh no, TikTok's terrible. Like, it's not it's not good for anybody." And I'm like, "Whoa, I'm turning into that person. Oh gosh." So it's definitely going to happen to us at some point.
You know what really, and this is a few years ago now, what really made me optimistic about TikTok, or at least kind of get it and feel better about it, is Hank Green, who does such a great job in science communication on TikTok. Like, I was like, okay, well, this is like a good way this thing can be used, like short, fun videos about science that help people understand. He does a lot of other stuff too, but kind of through him, I found this whole amazing world of like TikTok-based science communicators. That and music have been my ins to TikTok. And I don't have any real interest in being like super TikTok guy, but the vast majority of days I don't go anywhere near that fucking app. But what I do, there's some really fun, especially music stuff on there that I think is making the world a better place. Like, musicians on TikTok are great. I do want to move on to segments. Our first segment on the show is our pop culture recommendation segment. As always, I'm going to keep the introduction short. This is where you get to talk about a book, a movie, video game, whatever it is you've been enjoying recently. The name of the segment is What's Poppin', and the theme song gets inserted in post and goes here.
What's poppin'?
What's poppin'? Great. Now, Pete, I can't remember if I asked you this question last time. Do you remember what the theme song to What's Poppin' is? Do you have any recollection of hearing it ever?
I do. I couldn't sing it to you.
Great. So if you remembered what it was, what do you think your opinion of it would be? Like, if you were to have heard it, do you think you would have liked it?
Yes.
Great. Okay.
Wait, heard it and I did like it.
Oh, well, even better.
Do I have to pretend that I've not heard it?
No.
I'm confused. What's happening?
No, that's the yeah. Well, everyone.
Confusion is the natural response to what Brian attempts to do. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, if I had a coherent agenda, that might help. Layton, what's popping?
What's popping for me is a little bedroom pop duo called Coco and Claire Claire. That I found because I wanted to listen to the Mark Mothersbaugh Sims soundtracks, and they have a song called Sims 2 where they sample it. And I was just like, oh, this seems cool. And I've been listening to a lot of their stuff, and it's just really fun. Like, it's ultimate doing makeup in your room in the middle of the night music. Mm-hmm. And their music videos are really cute. So Coco and Claire Claire, check it out.
Great.
That's what's popping for me. Pete, what's popping for you?
Do you want on-brand or off-brand?
You can do both if you want.
You can.
Oh, awesome. On-brand is, so I'm a big fan of a podcast called The Studies Show at the minute, which I love as a title because it's The Studies Show, and Studies Show that blah, blah, blah.
Cute.
But this is completely nepotistic because it's my friend Tom Chivers.
The guy you mentioned, yes.
Yeah, Bayesian book fame. So it's him and another journalist called Stuart Ritchie, who has a very listenable Scottish accent, just talking about science and like talking about, here's the thing that everybody's worrying about. What does the evidence show? But it's not like in a like snarky, everybody's stupid sort of way. It's just, two guys trying to figure out what's actually going on. So like they take news stories. They did one last year about that whole room temperature superconductor stuff. Mm-hmm.
The stuff out of chat. What was it? LK99 or something like that?
Something like that. Yeah. Yeah. And then they've done stuff on like climate skepticism. They did one, attention, our attention spans actually collapsing, stuff like that. And it's just a really nice hour or so to listen to, just people trying to figure out what the hell's going on. And I love it. It's great.
Cool.
So what's the off-brand one?
I have developed a low-key obsession with WWE wrestling. So I...
Hell yeah.
So I used to love it when I was a kid. And then there was like a 10, 15-year gap where I completely forgot about its existence. And then I remembered it again. I can't remember whether I put this in the acknowledgements.
You did. You mentioned WWE GIFs, I believe.
Yeah. Oh no, it was, so I was going to thank Jim Johnson in the acknowledgements, who's the guy who invented most of the WWE themes.
Yes, I just remembered the WWE mention in the acknowledgements, yeah.
Because honestly, I'm not exaggerating. I listened to The Undertaker's theme tune on repeat for probably about 3 months while I was writing this. But then the other thing that's happened is that back in October, I bought a subscription to WWE Network. And I was like, I should catch up on all of the stuff that I've missed. So I have been marathon binge watching episodes of Raw. So I started off in October in 2010.
Wow.
And I've watched every episode of Raw and
every
pay-per-view.
Now that sounds like a podcast.
And I'm currently at March 2014.
Wow.
So it's about a year every 6 weeks at the minute. I'm now very concerned about what's going to happen when I get up to date and I'm not going to have that in my life anymore.
Right.
It sounds like a very interesting, like, cultural time capsule. I mean, you have a decade left with all your watching, too.
It must be fascinating. It's super weird because all these, like, these big events happen, and sometimes like there are these spillover things that happen. So there was one episode I was watching where they basically had to improvise the night because they only had like three wrestlers appear because there'd been a show in Europe and everybody had got stuck there because of the Iceland volcano.
Oh, the volcano!
Erupting.
Yeah. Wow.
The one that everybody loves to try and pronounce.
Ekafjokol or whatever, yeah.
Ekafjokol, something like that, isn't it? Yeah, so it's like, oh my God, I completely forgotten that that was a thing that even happened. And then there's just some like weird shit, man, right? There's an episode that was hosted by William Shatner, and they do this segment which is William Shatner singing WWE entrance themes.
Wow. Okay.
In his like spoken word
voice,
like he's singing the Shawn Michaels sexy
boy
theme.
Just listening to that album. Yeah.
It's incredible. Yeah. So yeah, it's weird. It's weird and great. And it's sort of become this weird comforting thing because I don't actually watch it. It's almost like I podcast it.
Yeah.
So I'm just like listening to it constantly. And one thing that I'll say is really annoying is that for some reason they went through this phase from 2012 to 2014, where something like big and serious happens at the end of every episode, but the commentators stop commentating for like the last 10 minutes or so, which is not helpful when you're just listening.
Just
to the
listening.
Audio.
Yeah.
It's not a great thing. So that's been a bit annoying. But yeah, that's my off brand.
Cool.
Great. Brian, what's popping?
What's popping for me is a new podcast that I've been listening to. My friend Andrew recommended it. It's called Wasn't That Special? And every episode is 1 year of SNL. So they start with a like how it all came together, and then they watch an entire season and then release a roughly 2 hour episode talking about it. And it's from a fairly like academic point of view. So these are guys who they're about my age, 50-ish. So they are almost as old as the show. They kind of have the same experience with it that I do. They were, you know, roughly the same age when the, you know, 80s casts and stuff were happening. And it's just really fun. I've been enjoying it. Generally, they have a few free episodes, but they run it through Substack. So you subscribe to it and, you know, you pay the whatever fee and then you get all the stuff. But it's just been a fun listen. SNL, you know, is one of the most influential TV shows of all time, obviously, you know, for comedy in particular. And it's very interesting to hear the behind the scenes stuff, you know, all these people that these comedy legends, but also the people that you've never heard of who were like there for half a season and then went away for whatever reason, just the number of people who have gone through and then either their careers were over or who went on to, you know, amazing other things. Like Julia Louis-Dreyfus was on SNL, you know, all these people who like popped in for a minute and then moved on to something else. I think Robert Downey Jr. was on briefly, right? Like, am I getting that right? I haven't gotten to that season yet.
Yeah, it was like coincided with him having a drug problem and that was the end of it, if I recall correctly.
Yes, there was like a notoriously bad season. Lorne Michaels left and then the show essentially almost went off the air. There were a few really dark seasons in the early 80s. But it's great. It's fun. And it's a, you know, I think it's interesting from a comedy history perspective. And also I always like accessible, but sort of academic analyses of comedy. It's why I love Jesse David Fox's Good One podcast. Like, these are people who know what they're talking about and do it in a nice, accessible and fun way.
Great. Yeah. That was What's Poppin'. Now it's time for our final segment, which we don't have like a lemon theme to go with One Peach.
No, we just call it One Peach Each, but we're going to do lemons too.
Yeah. What Brian just said. We're all going to say one thing that's annoying and one thing that's nice. Here, this is high effort podcasting. Theme song.
One peach, one peach each. One peach, one peach each. One peach, one peach each. One peach, one peach each.
Wow. We're banking a few episodes this week, so Layden's enthusiasm
for recording. I may or may not be running out of fucking steam. all right. Yeah. We'll start with a lemon each. I'll go first. Mine's just the Sisyphean nature of household chores. I just did dishes. Mm. The fuck do you mean I have to do them again? That's a raw deal. Laundry, I just did that. I don't want to do that again. But then you have to. Otherwise, there's more of it. Hello? Yeah.
Also laundry, especially when you have a kid, the laundry is like out of control.
I'm sure.
I find my daughter walks in the house from school. This is like this trail of socks and shorts and whatever else, a sweater, whatever else was on her body, just like leading from the door. So I'm constantly picking up tiny socks and being like, you know, and then doing laundry. Never stops. Yes. Good lemon.
Thank you. Y'all's lemons, please.
Pete. Got a lemon.
So when I got the email, it was three peaches and one lemon, and I felt really, really sad because I could only come up with one peach, and I came up with three lemons.
Okay.
I can do them really quick though.
Sure.
So lemon one is my back. My back can go to hell.
I'm sorry.
I turned 40 before Christmas, and I think my back turned 86. It's just horrible. Anyway, that's one. Number two is my dog has developed an obsession with eating tissues, which is really unhelpful. And it's now progressed to she will find boxes of tissues and eat the entire box. So that's not fun. We now have to take shares out in tissue making companies. but I think my primary one is, why do we have to have an app for everything? At work at the minute, they're trying to be super eco-conscious and get rid of one single-use coffee cups in the cafe. Mm-hmm. And in order to do that, they've got this app. So you can have a reusable cup from the coffee shop, but you have to log it in your app.
What?
And scan it and then return it.
Are you kidding me?
I point of principle, I'm not downloading the app, but it's scuppered me a few times this past couple of weeks because I've really wanted a coffee and I've gone there and they've not got any single-use cups. And I'm like, can I have a coffee, please? And they're like, yes, can you get a reusable cup with the app? And I'm like, no, I don't want to download an app and do all of that. And they're like, well, we can't give you a cup. And I'm like, but the cup's right there. I will give you money for it. I will buy the cup off you. I get very upset and angry and without any coffee by the end of it. So that is my main lemon.
I think that is the kind of thing that the UK in particular excels at, is this kind of like pointless bureaucracy, right? Yes. Where it's like, no, it's always someone who's like, look, I wish I could help you, but I can't give you a cup. And you're like, the cup's there. I can see it. Please hand it to me. No, you don't have the app. It's like, oh my God. Being a person who moved to the UK, setting up a bank account in the UK was an exercise in how many forms I could possibly fill out and get stamped. It was a truly soul-sucking process that a friend described to me correctly. He's like, another American who moved to the UK. He's like, okay, here's how it's going to happen. You're going to go to the bank. They're going to ask you for a thing. You're going to go get the thing and bring it back. They'll say that's not the right thing. Then you go back. This process repeats essentially infinitely until at one point you just have a bank account and no one's sure why. And that is 100% what happened to me. Eventually, I went back and I was like, okay, I have this form. I have the stamp of the thing. And they're like, yeah, this account was opened a week ago. Did nobody tell you? I was like, oh. Okay. Yeah, the UK is particularly good at this kind of pointless, and especially, I gotta say, at the university admin level too. It's like, why are we doing? I mean, I don't need to tell you.
Do you know what? It's been even worse since I've started doing freelance stuff, like doing book talks and things like that. Like trying to get paid for that stuff has become an absolute nightmare because you always have to sign up to their finance systems, and it's got so bad to the point now that I will actually happily do it now. I will happily sign up to your completely Byzantine finance systems, but I'm going to add a red tape surcharge to my invoice.
Right.
So I've just got like £50 red tape surcharge in there. And most of the time people pay it. And I'm perfectly happy to do it.
That's a great idea. Yeah.
All right. It's time.
Oh, wait, I didn't do my lemon.
Oh, shit. Sorry.
I'm just going to say real quick, this is a fast lemon. This is the most solvable problem in the history of the world. We have two showers and one bottle of shampoo, and I always pick the wrong shower. And I go to take a shower, and then I go to wash my hair, and I'm like, fuck. And then I have to get out sopping wet, walk. We have a small house too. Walk sopping wet across my living room into the other bathroom, get the shampoo, bring it back to the shower, and then wash my hair. I know what you're thinking. Why not buy another bottle of shampoo? I wish I could help you with that. Like, I just don't, you know, I don't know. Why don't we just buy another bottle of shampoo? I don't know. Two showers, one bottle of shampoo, two bottles of conditioner, by the way. Each shower has its own conditioner. This is what makes this problem worse, is that you're always going to have conditioner. But if you use conditioner without shampoo, that's, I can't do that. That's not me. So there's my lemon.
Thoughts and prayers, Brian. All right. It's time for each of us to do a peach. I'll go first. My peach today is that I am wearing false eyelashes and my eyes don't feel like they're about to fall out of my head, which is historically is how it's always gone. So thanks, shitty ones that I got off of Amazon. These are pretty good. So
great.
That's my peach. Nice.
I love it. Pete, what's your one peach?
Battenberg cake. I rediscovered the joy of this year.
I don't know what is it?
What is that?
No.
Do you not get Battenberg cake? It's like a checkerboard cake. So it's like yellow, pink
these
squares. And then it's surrounded in marzipan. Mm-hmm. And it's just like the greatest thing ever.
Yeah.
And I love Battenberg, but because I lost all of my hobbies over the past few years due to pandemic and kids,
including cakes,
I'd forgotten that they existed until yesterday. And then I went into the shops and it was on offer. And I was like, I'm going to have a Battenberg. And I've not looked back. It's been brilliant.
That's great.
Amazing. Brian, your one peach?
My one peach, this is a simple one. Got some friends coming into town, haven't seen them in a while. They're going to be around this weekend, and I'm happy to see them. It's a couple and their two kids in town from Florida, and it's just nice to see old friends. That's it.
That's awesome. The best peach.
Yeah.
Well, that's our show. Pete, thank you for coming back and for being so generous with your time.
No, not at all. Thanks for having me. Genuinely, I said this before we started recording, but I'm going to get it so it's on record, that I did this show like 3 years ago, was it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
2 years, 3 years ago. And it was kind of around my last book. And it was genuinely one of the most joyous things that I did in that time. So I've been super happy to be back. Thank you.
That makes me happy.
Yeah, same. It's just great to see you again. You know, I wish we had more time to actually spend together, but it's, you know, this is a good opportunity to sort of hang out. You know, thank God for screens is all I'm going to say here, because without screens, we wouldn't be doing this, right?
Yeah.
And if people...
Case closed.
Yeah. If people want to check out your books, where do they go? Yes. How do they find them?
So I'm struggling to find a US publisher at the minute, so it's going to be hard for people in the US to get it easily. I'm hoping that might change in the next couple of months, so you'll still be able to order it. But I think you can get it off Amazon and places like that. So it's called Unlocked, The Real Science of Screen Time and How to Spend It Better.
Can they get an electronic copy of that if you're in the US? Do you know?
I don't think so at the minute, but that will change quicker than the physical copies.
Yeah.
So I'm sure it's already up on illegal file sharing websites anyway. So that's not a problem. Yeah, my last book was called Lost in a Good Game. And that's available everywhere.
Yeah. And I know for in particular listeners of this show, we've got a lot of gamers, you know, and we said this last time, I think your books are of general interest to everybody, but also of people who listen to us, I think they're going to be particularly interested in in what you have to say. And also, who doesn't love a semi-contrarian, right? Like, yeah. it's nice to have a nuanced, reasonable perspective on what is essentially a moral panic that many of us in our heart of hearts know is complete bullshit. So, or at least frames the question in a reasonable way and says, hey, maybe we should just take a step back and think carefully about this before we start screaming.
Yes.
So, yes. Yeah. So anyway, it was great to see you again. Thank you for being here. It's so nice to chat again. And Leighton, do you want to close us out with some final words? High energy. Come on. Let's go. Let's go.
No.
Let's really, really bring us home.
Listener, I know what you did last summer.
Okay, great. Bye.
Goodbye.
Leighton Knight is produced by Brian Wecht, Leighton Gray, and Jarek Centeno. Follow us on Twitter at Leighton Knight, on Instagram at Leighton_Knight, or email us at LeightonKnight@gmail.com.